How's it going? And welcome back to On the Wire, a proud member of the Pitcher List Podcast Network. Follow the pod on the Twitter at On the Wire Pod. I'm Adam Howe, and as always, I am joined by the 2020 TGFBI champion, Kevin Hastings. Kevin, we are in the heart of draft season. How many drafts are you in right now at this very moment?
Right now, actually, zero. But I have a draft tomorrow night, I have a draft Saturday, I have a draft Sunday, and then next week I have my big one, the Auction Championship in FBC in Las Vegas. So it is really exciting. And then next week is also our first Fab weekend. So this is our last off-season topic show. It's so exciting.
Yeah, man. I envy you for heading over to Vegas and doing the event live. That is amazing. I look forward to the day that I can both afford to do that and actually get out of my house to do that too. Yeah, I'm looking at my tabs right now. I am in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 drafts, and they're nice. All completely different types of drafts. I'm doing a draft right now with the Pitcherlick staff. It's just a draft and stash. The only rules are you can only pick rookie eligible players, and the only stats are innings pitched and games played. So you don't care how they actually do. You just need to have them in the game. And so I was, that's fun. I did that last year, and there's no wrong answer really for the most part. And it's a ton of fun. But like between that and a guillotine league, Rad Slam, doing an NFBC 50 at the very moment as well. And that's getting into the weeds as well. So that's probably my last draft of the year. No, I have a home dynasty draft coming up in 2 weeks, but that's just supplementary. It's like rounds like 22 through 26 to fill out your rosters.
So the guys that we talk about.
Exactly. So it's beautiful that we talk about these guys every single week. I'm just helping myself do this. Like you mentioned, this episode will mark the last off-season episode of the spring for us. Starting next Sunday, we'll be diving headfirst into our Fab-infested waters, if you will. The season is beginning Thursday, April 1st, which means that the first Fab period on most leagues is Wednesday, the 31st. So our episode due to come out Sunday, next Sunday prior, will focus strictly on breaking down Fab and waiver wire options to start your season, because lots can change between the time you finish up your draft and the start of the season, especially if you're like Kevin and you draft back in October. And so that Fab period is actually really important between injuries, rotation battles, lineup trends, of course, bullpen shuffling. Today, however, we're going to stick to a more specific topic, and that is the aforementioned bullpen, the focus of many Fab budgets throughout the given season, and sometimes tells me this year to be equally exciting and disappointing as we've ever seen. So luckily, we are able to bring in the big guns for this one. Rick Graham ranks all the relievers worth knowing about on both saves and hold leagues throughout the season at pitcherlist.com, as well as manages an incredibly hardworking, incredibly intelligent, and some would say very good looking reliever team over at Pitcher List. Full disclosure, I am on that reliever team, so no bias whatsoever. That we watch the bullpen usage for every team every day, report back to you, so you don't have to miss a beat on what you're looking to get a leg up on, a closer change situation, or a possible vulture win, your daily move leagues. Rick is here to help us make sense of some of the more questionable bullpens across the league, while pointing us in the direction of some guys you might expect to see going for big Fab bids during the season. Rick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, you guys. I'm excited to dive into this pool of relievers that probably definitely the most volatile position out there when it comes to fantasy drafts.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially in drafts, you just ultimately you never feel good about it, the pick you're making, no matter where you're making the pick. You're just, this feels dirty, whether you're picking somebody in the fourth round or the 40th round. And so I'm glad you're here to maybe make us feel a little bit better about some of the picks, or at least make us avoid feeling extra bad about some other picks that we can avoid. But before we get into that, we're going to hit up our final moving targets of the week. These are some of our favorite late round picks, players that we're looking to draft in the final round or two of your standard 12 or 15 team roto leagues, 30 round drafts, currently going post 350 ADP using NFBC leagues. So players that are getting drafted in these 50 round leagues we're going to be talking about, but very well may be regularly available late, either in a typical 30 round draft or off your wire if nobody drafts them whatsoever. So we think that these guys are worth the final pick in some of your drafts And it's going to depend, obviously, on roster construction, what makes sense for your team and whatnot. So take this advice with whatever size grain of salt you want. But if you really think about it and what we have to say about these guys, they might be people, they might be players worth looking into, and they might be able to help you either early on in the season or as a complement to the rest of your roster. I'm gonna start us off because I think I have the most boring one on here. And it was, for those who listened to our episode last week, we did a full-on draft of these kind of players with the guys over from Keeper Cut and In the Deep. And this is a guy that Kevin and I talked about drafting, but we went a different direction. We ended up going with Marwin Gonzalez instead. Here, I'm going to talk about really quickly is Kike Hernandez. So the alternate multi-utility player in Boston, newly enshrined in Boston. And the thing that stands out for me with Kike the most is, besides his, you know, multi-position eligibility right now in NFBC, is available at second and outfield. There's an outside chance that he takes on some shortstop eligibility as well, as he spells Xander Bogaerts in Boston, at least early on in the season, if he needs a couple extra days off due to his current ailments. But besides that, and I want to give some extra credit to Mike Curlin, who puts together some great spring training lineup tracker as well. And if you look at his tracker and you notice that Kike has been leading off for the Red Sox every single game he's played in spring training this year. I believe he's only missed about four games. So he's played almost every game in spring training, and every single one he's either played shortstop, second base, or center field in the leadoff spot. So that's a really good indication, especially when teams are using this time to figure out what their lineups are going to look like. And a lot of times you'll see teams mixing and matching. Miles Straw being jumped around in the lineup in Houston because Houston is actually not sure if Miles Straw is going to be the leadoff guy opening day, and they want to see what's going on. Enrique is entrenched in that spot. And this is a guy who has not had the ability or the opportunity in LA to let his wings fly. He had 402 at-bats in 2018, 414 at-bats in 2019. And those were obviously his two best productive years, at least when it comes to counting stats. And if he was brought into Boston, in my mind, to be an everyday player, and I think that he chose to come to Boston because of the opportunity that they presented to him to do that, whether it's at second base or in the outfield or a mix of the two. So I do think he's going to get close to the 500 at-bats. If you look at a lot of the projections, they totally disagree with me. And nobody has him over 400 at-bats, right around 436 or 420 plate appearances. I think he's going to get more than that, especially with his versatility. As we talked about with Marwin Gonzalez last week, he has the ability to play multiple positions. And Alex Cora has said they're going to keep less hitters on their bench because of the versatility that their bench guys have, and they're going to be able to have more pitchers. So they're going to have less options to go to fill in at spots when they need it. So that's another reason. And then the last thing is, just if you look at Boston's schedule to start the season, first of all, they only have three off days in the entire month, and they're both, two of them are in the first 2 weeks. So they've got the weeks of the 11th through the 18th, and then, sorry, the 12th through the 18th, and the 19th through the 25th, seven games throughout the week. That's great in weekly matchups where you can't change your lineups out, and you're going to get those added days in lineups. He travels to Camden. He's playing in Minnesota. They host 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 17 games in Fenway. So he's got a really good offense. He's playing in a lot of really good ballparks to start the season. And he, at the top of that lineup, it's still a decent lineup. He's gonna score runs. At the very least, he's going to give you some pop in the run department. Somebody get me off the ledge on this one.
I love that pick. As a fellow Sox fan, it's not like he hasn't given us fantasy value before either. When he was playing, getting full-time a run in LA, he was contributing to fantasy lineups. And yeah, even if he's not at second base, like, there's still a need in the outfield. So like, he's going to find a way to be in the lineup, I would say, for at least 450 at-bats, maybe 500 at-bats this year. And hitting leadoff in that lineup. Yeah, you got Devers, Bogaerts, JD Martinez, Verdugo behind you. That's, you know, he's going to get some serious run production.
Yeah, absolutely. That's where I would go. That lineup is, I think you guys as Red Sox fans might be understating it a little bit when you're saying, oh, not that bad or pretty good. The top half of the lineup is really good, in my opinion, with Verdugo, JD Martinez, Bogaerts, Devers, all the, even Hunter Renfro driving in runs behind him. I think that's great. And those seven game weeks that you talked about, Adam, those are huge because we are talking about a guy that's going to get moved around. And when you're spelling guys, that means there's days that you're going to get spelled. But even if you play five games that week, when you're leading off, you're guaranteed, unless you get a perfect game thrown against you, which for you guys, I hope that's not the case. He's still getting at least four plate appearances, I should say, those games, and sometimes five. So it's a huge deal. He, even playing 5 out of 7 days, he's a full-time player when you look at it that way. So counting stats wise, which is what I'm looking at when we're looking at players in this area of drafts or even picking up off the wire, he's perfect.
Yeah, and he's definitely going to play, and I think he's going to play all year. He's got a 2-year contract, $14 million. Like, they didn't bring him in just to fill out the roster, if you will. Maybe you could say that about Marwin, but not. I don't think you can say that about Kike. And Kike was like one of their first signings of the offseason as well. Like, they went out and got him. So I think they have a lot of trust in him, and they want to give him that opportunity. All right, so I'm going to move on. We're going to go to Rick. I want to save Kevin's for last because I love Kevin's pick, and I think we're going to talk about it for a bit. So who did you get?
So I'll keep it reliever-centric, and I went with Jake McGee, whose ADP is skyrocketing right now. He's still after 350, but that's definitely – I know Gabe Kapler, he hates to name a closer, but McGee is by far the best reliever in that bullpen. And at his price point, if he may only get you 10, maybe he gets you 20 saves, but he's still going to be – he still should be good for ratios and Ks at a cheap price. He disappeared from Colorado for 4 years, and then LA picks him up and rejuvenates his career last year. It's surprising. You look at him, big lefty, you'd think, all right, he's probably got a great breaking ball. He threw only 10 sliders last year in 20-plus innings, and he had a 38% K to walk rate and a 1.81 Sierra throwing only fastballs. And it's not like an overpowering fastball. He sits around 95 miles per hour, so that's... Is it sustainable is a question, but guys, Sean Doolittle, when he was going well, he was pretty much a fastball only lefty who topped out around 93-94. Josh Hader, in his couple years ago, he was only throwing fastballs. He mixed in the slider here and there. So it's definitely sustainable, and there's no real competition there. You know, Reyes Maranta had some hype coming into the year, but his arm doesn't seem right. His velocity is way down. So yeah, I think McGee, if Kapler lets him, could be a guy that could run away with the closer job in San Francisco.
Yeah, Rick, to your point, like the ADP of Jake McGee is definitely skyrocketing. If you go to, you check him out on NFBC, you can see the graph on the trends of ADP, and it's just like a line that's going straight down. At the beginning of drafts, you know, he's going as high as 739 back in November, and I see the average out, sure, but I've got to pick 195 here on a recent draft, even 390. So it does average out. You can still get him late in drafts, but there's definitely guys willing to set those mins on him as well. So if you want him, good advice here. He knows his relievers. You're going to have to reach for him. You're going to have to get him, I think, at this point, as you get closer and closer to draft season.
Yeah, the thing I notice about Jake McGee here, and he's, what, 30? Almost 35 years old now. I guess this is still be his age 34 season as we're about to get ready. Those 4 years in Colorado, his ratios, like you would expect, just skyrocketed. Even though it was only 20 innings in 2020, he went back down to below a 3 ERA and a 1.67 FIP, just right back to what he was doing in 2014 and 2015 in Tampa. So getting out of Colorado and now going to San Francisco, which we love as a ballpark for pitchers. Yeah, this is a great, there's definitely good reasons he's skyrocketing in ADP.
All right. Well, I'm in one last, I have one more draft to go in my season. So definitely somebody I'm going to have to keep an eye on. I do not have any shares of Jake McGee yet, but I do have a tendency of taking the advice from our podcast all season. I was able to, for those who listened to our podcast last week, I was able to get, I think, 8 8 or 9 of the 18 guys we talked about in our draft last week in at the end of my Raz Slam draft.
That's awesome.
So you got to live what you preach. So if I'm going to give the advice, I've got to use it. All right. So save what I think is the best for last. Kevin, who are you going with for your final moving target of the offseason?
Yeah, this is it really can be looked at as a homer pick. I think most people know how big of a Kansas City Royals fan I am. But I've been drafting this guy in draft champions leagues since October, and now I drafted him in the 29th round of TGFBI with Bobby Witt Jr. As it seemed like a gamble even for 50 round draft and hold leagues in October. Now it's starting to seem like less of a gamble even in 30 round fab leagues. He may or may not start the season with the major league club. As a fan, I hope he doesn't, but I'm starting to really believe we're going to see him by the end of April. And at the very worst, as far as fantasy players, the end of June at the Super 2 time, however that's going to work out. And I don't even know if they've decided. Did that go back to normal after last year? I don't know if they even know what those dates are going to be this year. But everybody from the top down in the organization has nothing but awesome things to say about him, especially his teammates. And even more so, everything I've heard from Dayton Moore, every time I hear him speak on any broadcast, he's talking about the anti-Seattle Mariners that we heard a couple weeks ago. When the players tell the players let us know when they're ready by their performance, and when they're ready, we're bringing them up. And they did it. I know it's different with pitchers, but they did do it with Brady Singer last year. And so it's just, I really believe that we have a five-tool player going undrafted in mini leagues. Now, I jumped him. I didn't wait till the last round in TGFBI because the hype is starting. It's getting there. So I took him in the 29th round. I just took him one round early because I think people are starting to throw this dart. But it's to the point now where even in redraft fab leagues, I'm taking that chance.
Yeah, man. After we talked about the pick you were going to make here, I grabbed him in two different leagues. I'm just like, after hearing all that hype, I'm like, you can't not be in on it, especially if the cost of the pick is just nothing. 29th round to TGFBI is not a big deal. Right. Worst case scenario, he's your first drop. I heard Paul Sport talking about this on Sleeper of the Bust the other day, and he's absolutely right. He's like, he's your first drop. What's the big deal? And the beauty, something we brought up a couple pods ago, is that in NFBC, you can't bid on prospects during season unless they were drafted. So the beauty of your league in TGFBI, if you do drop him early in the season, you could keep an eye on him. And if you
more
hear wind,
you keep an eye on Nicky Lopez. And
sure.
If he's as bad as he has looked so far, you pick him right back up.
And you pick him up for $1 or, $10 just to be safe or whatever, not the $400 that it'll cost the day he gets called up. And so like in my league, I don't have that luxury. I'm going to have to wait until he gets called up, even if it's after Super 2, and he'll be a $400 fab guy for sure. He'll be the Jordan Alvarez of this year, and you gotta hold on to that hammer if you want him. You're gonna have to this year. So I love it. I ended up getting a pick 404 in my Raz Slam draft like hours after you told me that, and I'm like, all right, I'm doing this, I don't care. And I picked him up at he was my very last pick in the Guillotine League that I'm in through pitcher lists through the Wacky Leagues. I mean, that's awesome, because if I lose a week, all my players go back into free agent pool anyway, so it doesn't really matter. Those leagues they're fun just because it's like sometimes you have no idea what you're doing, and it's fun just to be out of your comfort zone, to say the least. Right, what do you think of this?
I love that pick. And you know what I was just thinking? I think there's definitely a real chance. I would assume we would see Bobby Witt Jr. before Wander Franco. And where's Franco going now? He was inside to like the top 300. ADP, and yeah, people just seem to be we're sleeping on Bobby Witt, as this is a top 10 shortstop prospect who's tearing it up in the spring. And it's great to hear that the Royals are like at least willing to consider being aggressive and like having one of those, like Fernando Tatis, like having like one of those type of call ups early in the year, which is awesome to see from them. I love that Darth Rowe late in drafts. That could pay off real big in the long run.
Yeah, Franco is an ADP of about 260. Franco is still a 260 ADP in recent drafts within the month of March, at least on the online championships. And he's already been sent down. And it's like Witt, surprisingly, has not been sent down. That's, and it's not like Kansas City's not sending people down. They send a handful of guys down to the minors already. And he's
two different times.
Yeah, and he's made the cut every time.
Again today with everybody else is definitely a starter that was in their lineup today. And one other thing that I haven't brought up yet, and I actually just realized it right now, he will be multi-positional eligible because he's coming up as a shortstop. He's eligible as a shortstop right now. If he plays, he will be either at third base or second base. So after a week or two, he will be multi-positional eligible.
Yeah, and like you said before, that hype is building. Out of the last 47 online championships that have concluded, he's been drafted in 11 of them, and he's got an ADP of 351 in those drafts. So he is not being forgotten about now, like in the, at least, and I guarantee you, those are the last 11 OCs. Somebody really took a chance about a month ago, maybe. But and these are smart people who are playing these leagues. They know that this pick is worth the stash for sure. Especially when you have Emily, everything about this to me echoes Tatis from last year. Like the way he played in spring training, the way the clubhouse talked about him, and everybody on the outside thinking there's no chance San Diego is going to play the time manipulation game. They're going to want him for as long as possible. And lo and behold, opening day roster without an extension. So there's definitely precedent for it. They don't have to. And to your point before, Kansas City is doing pro player moves. Like they're doing what they think is right for their players. And like you said, the players tell them when they're ready. So even though he hasn't made it past rookie ball in official games, he had the alternate site last year, which he had good reviews from what I read out of the alternate site as well. So who's to say? It's too exciting not to be part of it.
Yeah. And without getting too much off track, I want to get your guys' opinion. I think in my mind that this may change. 2020, all kinds of things went on. We're going to react and do different things. But major league organizations, I think a lot of these young players developed better at the alternate sites than they would have playing at A ball. They had better coaching, they were facing better competition. And this might change things going forward. What do you guys think?
I think it made a big difference for those players who had really good talent around them. And so if the teams like Seattle that have like talent up the wazoo down their minor league system, like they're facing off against really talented, like their hitters are facing off against Logan Gilbert, Emerson Hancock, and what have you, and George Kirby. And so they're able to see these really talented, advanced pitchers that they wouldn't normally see throughout their minor league season when they're facing off against teams that aren't as good. I think for me, there's a possibility that for the teams that don't have as deep of a minor league system, or at least not a high-end talent, it either was the same or it might have actually hurt them a little bit. But to your point, the one thing that I think is constant across the board is that they had more one-on-one training and like coaching with their coaching staff. Again, I think that matters about who their coaching staff is, though. And so I think there are some teams that probably were hurt by it just because the talent level across the board is just not as good. But I think the other teams probably went above and beyond for sure.
Yeah, I'd agree with both your points there. I remember hearing a lot of good things about, from the Red Sox perspective, like Tristan Cassis and Jaron Duran hitting well in Pawtucket last year. And they're facing, it's the Red Sox pitching staff. Depth wasn't great last year, but they're still going up against AAA, AA pitchers at that level. And when they normally, Cassis would have been at probably high A last year. So yeah, they definitely should be a little bit more experienced and I think it's going to help them when the minor league baseball starts up again this year. When those guys start out in double A, it's like we've seen this type of pitching before. This is what we were going up against last year.
Yeah, even if they do start off like a double A, they may cruise right through it.
Yeah.
You made me just a little sad as a Red Sox fan by bringing up Pawtucket. And
I was trying to think what pitchers they would have faced down there, and it's not pretty.
Oh, just that it's gone.
That too, I know.
And they moved to Worcester.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to miss Pawtucket. It's a great place to see a game. I remember seeing Robert
Worcester. Down there. I heard the Woe Sox, that stadium's...
It looks nice. It does look very nice, yeah. So hopefully we can get out to games like later this summer. Definitely want to check that out.
Oh, those are the days right. that we all look forward to. All right, so we'll move. All right, let's move on. I think the Bobby Witt is just too exciting of a pick that we can't stop on that. We got to keep going. We got to push through it. And all right, so we're going to get to the main crux of the episode, and we're talking about relievers, everybody's favorite topic. And we're trying not to. I try not to put too much of a structure on this episode where we're just listing relievers. That's not the point. I don't want Rick to go through every reliever, every bullpen. You guys can follow the bullpen report on pitcherlist.com every day if you want that kind of in-depth analysis. Right now, I really want to pick your guys' brain about different strategies revolving around drafting relievers and then also picking relievers up throughout the course of the season, how you guys do that and what the things you guys look for when you're evaluating. And so, Kevin, I'm going to start with you with this first question. We are show all about FAB. And so I want to talk to you about how you recommend or how do you, and then thus, how do you recommend people budget FAB for relievers? Like how much is too much? And is it the same early in the season versus the end of the season? Can you dive into that process for me and our listeners?
I think it sounds so stupid to say it this way, but it's more of an art than a science. I hate using that phrase, but it is because it's definitely not exact. For example, if we're using NFBC style and many other leagues, and you can adjust this depending on your league, but I'm going to reference $1,000 FAB budget. I set aside about $200 to $250 in my initial budget. That is for the big one, whether that be, and it may be a closer, or someone I think is going to be a closer. Hopefully, if it's one of these big prospects that comes up, like you mentioned in many leagues, Bobby Witt Jr., we were just talking about, didn't get drafted, so he won't be eligible to be bid on until he plays in a major league game, and then he'll go for $400+. Hopefully, I don't need that guy. That's one thing we get caught up in. If your team, if I have Trevor Story and Dansby Swanson, and they're both performing well, I don't need a shortstop. Let someone else spend the money. And so I think that's one component that I always keep in the back of my mind. I don't need every great next FAB guy. I can let someone else spend the money on him. But I have that money set aside for one, maybe break it in half, two bigger guys throughout the year. I am not going to run out of money at the end of the season either, but it's not week to week. If I have $800 for 26 weeks, that's approximately $30 a week. It's not 30 all season. I better not need $30 each week the last month to month and a half of the season, or I'm in trouble and I'm not competing anyway, if that's the case. So it's a diminishing thing each week throughout the season in my mind. And hopefully we're looking far enough ahead, and a lot of people are doing it now. So it may not just be 2 weeks anymore. Maybe we're looking at schedules 3 weeks ahead now. And it's going to come up later where we're going to talk about something else along these lines. But some weeks I might only spend $10 or $15. So spending $40 or $50 some weeks is okay. But two things that I want to reiterate. I'm going to have a couple hundred bucks set aside for one big guy that I think I need, and I'm not going to run out of money at the end of the season. Now, whether this ends up being on relievers or not depends on my team 100%. I might have to spend that 200 plus on a reliever. If everything's going well, I won't have to. And then I'm just spending a couple bucks looking at a guy that might jump in there 3 weeks from now.
Yeah, I want to echo what you said on there about not running out of money at the end of the season. You can't take it with you. What's the point of not spending that fab money? And there's something to be said about placing, keep them honest bids and just being stuck with the guy that nobody bids on. But as long as you don't go too high, it's really not a big deal. They can still be useful to you, even if you have two shortstops, what have you. But
yeah, at the end of the season, I'm going to have money if I have injuries and have to have a guy for that last week. I'm going to have that money. If I don't need it for that, I am going to look at my closest competitors and pick up who I think they need.
Personally, I'm spending money every single week, regardless. Exactly. Regardless if I need it.
Bucks.
Exactly. I'm going to make sure that my roster is built in such a way where I have no problem spending $1 to $10 every single week to fill something. And whether it be a need or just a bench piece, or if I'm in a great spot, looking ahead 3 weeks, to your point, looking for a guy that probably will go two starts 3 weeks from now, if you will. And so I can spend $10 on that guy rather than $115. And so,
of course, injuries can blow a hole in all of this, whether it be that your bench is full of injured guys or you really need a replacement for an injured guy. And I think what the short season taught me last season that I really want to carry forward, because the short season made it easier to let guys go. I really think even in a longer season, that's the smart move anyway, as much as we hate to do it. Like, this guy is better than what I can replace him with 6 weeks from now when he comes back. But guys don't come back and just start performing the way we expect them to when they come back from injury. I'm going to try really hard to continue to just cut bait.
Yeah, and to your point too, throughout the season, we're going to keep referencing the $1,000 budget. And so you guys listening, you can equate that to what your budget is. If you hear us throw out a number, know that we're using a $1,000 budget. If you have a $100 budget, that's an easy translation. If you have a $500 budget, not that hard. So think about that. We'll try to talk in percentages whenever we can. But if we throw out a dollar amount, know that we are using a $1,000 base point. Rick, when you're in a fab league, with all the experience you have of watching bullpens, how are you budgeting? Are you even bothering to budget your fab for bullpen additions? Or are you just know that you can find the guy maybe 3 weeks in advance and be right pretty much every time?
I wish, but
wish, right?
I think to both of your points, like you brought up, Adam, how you're going to spend at least some money each week. And I like to do that. I like to, with like my end of my roster guys, I like to speculate on, okay, what reliever has been struggling, or and who's potentially the next guy in line? Can I get ahead of the curve a week or two in advance before he gets swapped out? I do think that you should have, there's probably going to be one reliever you're going to want to like splurge on. I don't know about like two. I saw some guys go for $250, $300 last year in the shortened season. But
the shortened season, that was so different.
Yeah.
$1,000 to spend in only 2.5 months.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so I splurged at least on two guys, and they did not work out. But I didn't feel that bad about it, only because, you have $1,000 to spend between a little bit of July, August, and September, rather than April through September, where obviously it needs to be spread out a little bit more.
So that's the thing, too, is a lot of the times when, okay, a closer is injured or he lost his job, I feel like it's almost never, oh, this guy's definitely going to come in and be the guy. It's always like three names you hear. And I feel like the one that's always hyped up the most, that you spend the most money on, ends up not being the guy who gets the saves, who gets the next chance to close out games. So I always like to, like, again, like, maybe I'm probably not going to go after that big name. I'm going to go after the secondary option and get him for significantly less. And if it works, if it doesn't, I'm playing the waiver wire again next week, trying to find who else I can add.
Yeah, I think even though there are some managers that are more, you know, old school and stick with a guy in the ninth inning, they still have a guy that they prefer in their higher leverage situations earlier in the game. And so when they lose their ninth inning guy, they don't want to lose that guy too. So it becomes the next guy. Everybody assumes, oh, the setup guy is coming in. But no, then you're losing your setup guy and you lost your closer, right?
Yeah, I totally agree. That happens year after year, I feel like. If, say, like Josh Hader were to get hurt like last year, oh, Devin Williams is going to be the guy. Devin Williams might just stick in that seventh, eighth inning role, and they'll go with someone else in the ninth inning. You never... it's not necessarily the most talented guy behind the closer that's going to become the closer.
Kevin, your segue skills are on point this episode. So I'm going to move right into our next question. Rick, I want to pick your brain about, you've been doing these reliever rankings over at Pitcher List for a long time and looking at these bullpen situations daily for a couple of years now, if I'm not mistaken. And I'm curious to know if you've noticed any particular tendencies across the league, whether it be via a certain manager or just a team mindset. And we hear people talk about how this team does things a certain way, or this manager, I can't trust them. You guys just brought up Gabe Kapler and what have you. Have you noticed any tendencies with teams that like to stick with a single guy in closer, or even if they struggle? Versus teams that like to mix it up. Everybody makes jokes at how many closers, how many guys got saves for Tampa Bay last year? I think it was 13. And so there's obviously two extremes, but have you noticed anything as you've been watching these bullpens?
Yeah, that's the thing. I touched on Gabe Kapler and the Giants situation a little bit, and he just never has really locked in on one closer in his years of managing. Not to say it won't happen, but he just hasn't. And then, yeah, like the Rays, which we talked about earlier off the air, that Kevin Cash is, and the Rays are considered, yeah, like a lot of people don't expect them to have a full-time closer. But if you really go back and look at Cash and the Rays and their track record, it hasn't been until recently that they've gone by this closer by committee route. Colum A was there for a while, Boxberger. Even when Pagan was closing out games for them, he got 73% of the saves for that team that one year. I think that was 2018. So there really isn't. I think it all depends on personnel and who you have in your bullpen and who you trust, as far as if you're going to go with a committee or if you're going to go with the one guy approach. But this year, it definitely seems like there's going to be plenty of bullpen by committee situations, whether it be Tampa Bay, Atlanta, Minnesota, San Diego. There's all sorts of unknowns in those places as well.
Yeah, contracts have got to play a role in this as well. I referenced this before, but like the sunk cost of Wade Davis in Colorado, it's like you pay this guy so much money, no matter how bad he is, he's still closing games, or I don't know what closing is the right word for it, but he's still ending games. And so I think that has got to play a little bit of a role in ego as well in some of these guys. They just won't let you, if you're going to pay them this much money, they feel like they have a say in where they're going to play. Yeah, Craig.
Right now.
That's a perfect example. No matter how bad they get. I can go back to the Sox, like Keith Foulke was a good example of that as well. It's like he was a great closer for a while, but that contract that he got in Boston, and just because he closed out a World Series, it meant that he was going to be a closer for years after that. Not the case per se, but like, there's some guys that just have that ego and they have the dollars behind it to say or dictate how they're going to be used or where they're going to play. And it's interesting to see situations kind of change. To your point, in Tampa Bay, like they've had a single closer for a long time, or at least one guy that's gotten the good bulk of the opportunities and converted, and then changed very recently within the last year, 2 years, really. And it just becomes such a norm, if people talk about it so much, that it feels like it's been happening for a decade, but it's really only been recently.
Yeah, you're right. And to you, like the point about the guys who are getting paid, yeah, they're going to have the longest. They're not going to, if they struggle out of the gate, they're not going to get replaced right away. Kenley Jansen and Aroldis Chapman are definitely two guys that come to mind. But even now, yeah, like Kimbrel's been awful again this spring. Are the Cubs really going to let him just continue to implode in the ninth inning of games? But they probably will, because they're paying him. And
for like what, like, next 5 years?
It's
a longer contract than I think people realize.
Don't pay for closers. Yeah, it's hopefully Liam Hendricks is going to be fine in Chicago. I don't think his stuff's going anywhere. It's like the double-edged sword. You pay for a guy, and then if they don't succeed, you feel obligated to keep running them out there in the ninth inning and like close ball games. And
Rick, do you think there's a concern with taking nothing else into consideration? Is it a concern for a reliever, specifically a closer, changing teams? Do you have any concerns with Liam Hendricks doing what Edwin Diaz did to fantasy drafters.
That's definitely something, because yeah, when Hendricks moved, it's not ideal. I guess you want to see, like, he's had success in Oakland. It would be nice if he was just still in Oakland and you don't have as much worry, because yeah, you go to a different city, you have different teammates, like all sorts of variables come into play when you're switching teams, and now you got the pressure of a huge contract that you have to live up to. Like, I say I don't want to worry about Hendricks, but I still, there's always the unknown, especially with closers. Yeah, like you said with Diaz, it's with other, all like the other closers we've just been naming, like Wade Davis goes to Colorado, implodes right away. Mark Melanson, when he went to San Francisco, that contract blew up in their face. Kimbrel in Chicago. So yeah, these guys go to different teams. They're so volatile. You really don't know, you know, what it's going to be like in a new situation, in a new setting.
And you got Liam Hendricks left a great ballpark. Yeah. And on the opposite end, now we got Trevor Rosenthal being dropped into a great ballpark. And it's just crazy. There's so many things to consider with these guys.
That's, yeah, like Rosenthal is moving, but I like that. Yeah, he's moving to Oakland. Just seems to be able to, whatever closer they, whoever they put in the ninth inning, like they've, Blake Treinen struggled as for a stint in 2019, but they seem to be a great place for closers to be in general. They've had good seasons out of Treinen, out of Hendricks, and I would assume Rosenthal does the same thing.
Yeah, Rosenthal obviously coming from San Diego, not a hitter's paradise either. And obviously before that, Kansas City, also pitcher friendly as well. Mm. So he's got a type, if you will. So that's good for him. So Rick, I'm going to list off, there's 11 closers going before ADP 120 this year. And I like to say top 10 closers, but as you guys pointed out to me, I actually missed one. So I had to throw in an 11th guy in here. I won't say which one I missed. So I'm going to list them off for everybody. Everybody understands where they're going as their drafts are coming up. And again, your ADPs, if you're playing on Yahoo, CBS, ESPN, what have you, Fantrax, your ADPs are going to be a little bit different. Just know that we use NFBC ADPs just because these are high stake leagues. These are guys who, you know what, most of them have an idea of what they're doing and they do their research. And so there's a lot of trends. There's also a lot of drafts to get this data. So I'm using...
It's easy to sort.
It's extremely easy to sort
different types of leagues. That's my biggest thing with it.
Yeah, league size as well, and the date is huge. So like, you never want to look at ADP. I can't stress this enough. Look at ADP data, or if you're in your draft, most draft software will show your ADP and like the rankings of players. And the ADP data is usually from the very first draft that happened till the draft that just concluded before your draft. And that very first draft that happened could have happened, like Kevin did, in October. And that ADP data is crazy different. So I'm using ADP data from NFBC online championships that happened between March 1st and March 16th. So there's 43 drafts in this time. So a lot of data. These are 12-team leagues as well and 30 rounds. And for those not familiar with NFBC rosters, there's 9 pitcher spots. There's no starting pitcher, no relief pitcher. They're just 9 pitcher spots. And you do have to, your pitching lineups do get locked for the entire week. So starting it off, the 21st overall pitcher off the board at ADP 60 is Josh Hader. Pretty much back-to-back is Liam Hendricks. He's the 23rd. Corbin Burns is right in between them. All same ADP of 60. Aroldis Chapman, 23rd pitcher or 24th pitcher off the board. ADP of 66. Edwin Diaz, ADP of 70. Orisiel Iglesias in LA at ADP of 79, Karen Track in Cleveland at 89, Ryan Presley in Houston, 93, the aforementioned Trevor Rosenthal in Oakland at 97, Brad Hand now in Washington at 103, Kenley Jansen still a Dodger at 105, and Kirby Yates in Dunedin, if you will, to start the season for the Blue Jays at 117. So a lot of these guys in the top 11 are changing teams between Hendricks, Iglesias, Rosenthal, Hand, and Yates, all changed teams this offseason for various reasons, whether they signed or got traded. And my question to start it off using this information, Rick, is give me who are the top 3 guys in this list that are the most likely to lose their job first?
I'd say the first two that stick out to me are, I would say, Brad Hand and Kirby Yates, I think, are for a combination of reasons. I think with Yates, it's health concerns. Brad Hand, there's overusage concerns. The fastball has been on decline the last 3 years. And both of those guys have two closers in waiting behind them, Tanner Rainey and Jordan Romano, who, like, those two guys are going to be closing out games at some point in their career, whether it's some point this year or next year. Those guys have elite stuff. Yates has been slow in his recovery from last year's elbow injury, so I think he's only appeared in one spring training game so far, and the velocity, at least readings, they were a little low, but that's what kind of what you expect first game back after a long layoff. And with Brad Hand, Terry Francona abused him like he abused Andrew Miller. He's been overworked the past 4 years, and Brad Hand is the only pitcher to have appeared in 300 or more major league games since 2016. At some point, that feels like that's going to catch up to you. I'll give a third name that might be a surprise, but Josh Hader, he really has been mediocre at best since the second half of 2019, going through last year. The home run issue is a legitimate concern. He finds barrels more than anyone else in the league. He's already been giving up home runs in spring training. And Devin Williams is probably the best reliever on that team. So, not to mention Hader, which we'll get to later. Hader's been nonstop in all these trade talks. So, I would say Hader, Hand, and Yates would be the three I would expect to. Also, James Karinchak, which, is he even the closer in Cleveland? There's been no guarantee on that. And it seems like it might not even be his job. So, I'd say those four.
Yeah, that Cleveland bullpen was brought up on our last episode. Chad Young, our resident Cleveland fan, Cleveland baseball team fan, he was pretty confident in Whitgren, ending up with that role in Cleveland as well. And if you look at some ADP data recently, you can see obviously that he's not the only one that thinks that it's going to be the case. No, still no more than like a flyer, if you will. Nobody's confident enough to switch ADP with a Karinchak, if you will. But yeah, I guess I'm curious to know a little bit if you have any more insight onto that. And also, like, the Oakland bullpen, we talked about Rosenthal as well being new in a new ballpark with a new team. And he obviously has the injury concern, or at least the history, that could happen at any time. I drafted Diekman at least two places, and one of them happened, like, I drafted Diekman a day before the signing of Rosenthal in Oakland. So I'm like, that felt really good. And it felt good before. And still to this day, recent ADP shows that Diekman's the only one that anybody has any faith in either taking over the job for Rosenthal or possibly just being a good setup guy. He's got an ADP of 338. He was drafted in 22 out of the 43 OCs we're talking about, as opposed to Wendelken, JB Wendelken, who was only drafted once. And no love for Lou Trevino or Sergio Romo, who obviously Romo has a history. He's been a closer. He got some closing opportunities last year in Minnesota as recently. So talk to me a little bit about those two situations between Emmanuel Klaas Whitgren in Cleveland versus Karinchak, and then the opportunity of who would be next in line in Oakland if Rosenthal either goes down with an injury or falters.
Yeah, I was with you on Diekman. I think I had him as my 10th or 11th closer. I put out my first, like, closer rankings, I think, 2 days or a day before Trevor Rosenthal signed there. And yeah, I was high on Diekman. I'm like, I didn't think Rosenthal would end up there. It's not like the A's to spend money like that. So yeah, I think even if you drafted Diekman, you're still gonna get a lot of K's. You're gonna get a good. He walks a lot of guys. That's his problem. But he had some luck last year. But he's still gonna get pretty good ratios and K's. And yeah, there's risk with Rosenthal. No doubt. I mean, he missed 3 years, and then like last year, he just comes out of nowhere. He's all of a sudden back to the 2015-2016 Cardinals version of himself, which I still like Rosenthal. I think that's here to stay, assuming health. But Diekman's one of those handcuffs that even if he's not closing out games, he can still give you value. And yeah, eventually Rosenthal might have to miss some time with something, and he gets you some saves, because I think Diekman would be the guy getting saves there.
Kevin, you talked about this before, this strategy, on a previous podcast and then on an alternate during PitchCon, about just targeting or not overpaying, but paying a little bit above ADP for a guy you feel is going to be in the role all year round. You're not going to have to worry about it because saves are going to be spread out across the league. In theory, you might actually need, you're going to need less saves to not only win the category, but at least just get you to in the top 80 percentile. So of this list, how many, which one do you have the most shares of, and who would you be targeting? Who are you targeting in like any future drafts or in your auction? Not to give anything away to your competitors.
I've been really upfront about this all offseason. As you said, I want one guy. I don't need two. It's hard enough doing one, and I've never done this before. And it's, as we were talking off air, it's so uncomfortable doing this. There's so many good starting pitchers and so many good hitters available when you have to make this move. But I want one of these guys. And I think my cutoff is on the list you mentioned earlier, you went in order. My cutoff is Rosenthal, and he's probably the one I have the most of. And it's, I'm in that Rosenthal, Iglesias are going in about the same spot in the drafts I've been in, getting one of those guys. And the reason is it's not as much about them. It's about the rest of the teams in Major League Baseball. I think we're going to continue to see this move to the saves for each team being spread among three or four guys. So if I have one of these guys in my lineup, he's going to get me the counting stats in a category that someone else in my league may have to play two guys to get, which means I can have another starter. That's my philosophy. I don't know if it's going to work or not. I'm hoping, but I've never made this move before. I've never taken closers this early, but I want one of those top six or seven.
Yeah, I took that advice to heart personally early on this offseason. Of the five NFBC drafts that I've concluded so far, I've got Edwin Diaz in three of them. And so he's been the guy that I've been targeting. And more often than not, I've ended up with it does feel dirty drafting a guy, a closer that early. But you know what? It feels really good to not worry about it, like to not sweat it out later on in the draft. And we talked about this a couple weeks ago about how you can't be complacent, especially when you're like, if you get a Mondesi type of guy and feel like, oh, I've got 40, 50, 60 stolen bases in the bag, I don't have to worry about stolen bases the rest of the season. That's the wrong attitude. Same exactly. Can be said about closers. Edwin Diaz could be pulled out anytime. He could have his troubles. He could get hurt and you're just done. So you still have to worry about the backups. But as far as just feeling like none of these guys, none of these 11 guys are sure things, but there are some guys you feel a lot more confident. Like I feel way more confident about Edwin Diaz, honestly, than I probably do about anybody on this list. And that's why I was targeting him. I don't think people I think people are realizing it now, but like at first, at the beginning of the offseason, I don't think people were realizing how good he actually was last year. I mean, he was amazing.
He was great in everything except the save category.
Yeah.
They should come.
He had two or three bad games to start the year, but I'm glad because I'm on the exact same page with you guys on all of this. And I usually every year I'm like, don't draft the closer until pick 150. But this year, yeah, you have to take one of those top six, seven, eight guys, or you're really hurting yourself when it comes to getting saves. I'm probably fading Hader and Hendricks. They're still a little too rich for my taste, but Diaz I have as my top closer heading into the year, and that's a guy I've been getting a lot. That Diaz, Chapman, Iglesias, Presley range, someone there, or Rosenthal, if I miss out on those guys, those are like the five I'm narrowing in on. But Diaz and Presley are the two that I've been trying to get the most shares of.
And I think there's a pretty big drop after that.
Oh, yeah.
I think Rosenthal's my last one, and then it's then I feel like I might as well wait a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Because, like, yeah, going back to Karinchak and Wickren, which, like, Wickren is very, that's a very bland, that's not an exciting save pick for me, and that would really, you know, that wouldn't be as fun as James Karinchak closing out games, but knowing Terry Francona and his history of favoring veterans and guys he can trust that who've been around a while, it's probably going to be Wickren. So yeah, I'm not even looking at James Karinchak at his current ADP. And that's, yeah, that's who you're going to be getting after Rosenthal. So yeah, you got to get one of those top six.
So here's, if like over this next week, this should become more clear for some things. We see a lot of starting hitting lineups out there several days over the next week before the final week. They start resting those guys. And we'll start seeing who we think will be the closer, usually following the starter, right? It's, they're not going to pitch in the ninth, but the guys coming in, we're going to get an idea. If what several are thinking, if it looks like it's going to be Wittgren in Cleveland, where does he fall on this list then?
If Wittgren gets the job, because Francona.
A lot of us are going to be drafting next weekend in some really big leagues. So if we think he has the job, where are we going?
Oh, man. You probably bump him in front of or in the same tier as Richard Rodriguez, Rafael Montero, Anthony Bass, like those closers who are pretty much locked into the role. Their stuff's, they're not going to give you, you know, four category help. They're going to just pretty much get you saves, maybe a low ERA, but that's about it.
I could see Wickren being drafted a little bit higher than that. He does give you some Ks. He had a 28% K rate last year. You know, for a reliever, you expect it to be in the high 20s or what have you, especially if they can dial it up. But if he's got adrenaline running, and I mean, he's had that kind of a K rate in Cleveland. He didn't really have that when he was in Miami over the last couple of years between 2016 and 9. He's only had just under 20%, then 23.5%, 21%, and then up in Cleveland, jumped it up to 26% and 28.5% last year. So he does have the opportunity. If he's announced, like, Tito comes out and says, Wickren's going to be closing out games to start the season, I can totally see him. Let's see. You said, you mentioned some guys and some teams that I just don't think that the save opportunities are going to be as high as they are in Cleveland, controversy has been revolving around that organization as of late, between starting off with getting rid of Lindor and then everything that's been happening ever since. I still think that they're going to have an opportunity in the Central to close out a lot of wins. And so I can see him, if he's in the same range as, say, would you take Wittgren or Kirby Yates at that point when it comes down to it? So it's like, I think
that was Wittgren exactly the question I had in mind.
Sorry to steal that from you then.
No, but it's perfect.
Like, that's 100. That's close to a top 100 player. Like, Yates is going at 117. And can you see yourself taking take away his name, but can you see yourself taking the Cleveland closer? And people are doing that with Karinchak right now within the top 100 picks. It's hard to say yes to it now because you're like, you haven't had time to wrap your head around it. But if the announcement happens today,
I wish people could see the look on Rick's face right now.
if the announcement were to happen today, you have to make that decision. Like, you might have to be the first person to make that decision. You don't have the history of other people doing it to affect you, especially this time of year, to Kevin's point. So yeah, Rick, the gun to your head, you need a closer. Who are you picking? Kirby Yates in Toronto or for the Blue Jays with his injury history, or Nit Wickren, who's never really had a closing position before and you have no idea how he's going to do. He has the job.
So my philosophy is typically I'm going to go upside over. There's no upside with Wickren. With Yates, like, that guy was a top two closer in the league at one point not too long ago. I know there's injury risk, but what Nick Wickren is going to get you, and who's to say he's going to be closing out games for the whole season? That's unlikely for most guys, definitely unlikely for someone like Nick Wickren. So if he's going around that 100 pick mark, I'm just going to let someone else take him. And if I can get James Karinchak for, like, at the end of the draft for nothing, I would love that. That would be awesome. To, even if he's not closing out games, he's given you K's ratios, and he'll get some saves, he'll get some wins. So I tend to go talent over role to a degree, to a point, but if I'm drafting someone early like that, I want both, like, the upside and security.
All right, so
your cutoff is, we're still cutting it off at 7. We're not adding Wickren.
I think there's a case to be made where you could put Wickren after this top 11, where, like, after Yates, it's what, Craig Kimbrell territory? And
no, you got, see, right after Yates, a couple pitchers later, is Nick Anderson going at 148, Craig Kimbrell at 155, and then Colome at 158. Those are three back-to-back-to-back relievers. Montero is a couple pitchers later at 164. So personally, I can't see myself not taking Wickren with the job in Cleveland over any. I would take him over all those guys.
I should have never asked this question.
Over all those guys, it saddens me almost to, yes, I would probably take him over all those guys, because it's a good job to have. It's Francona is not going to give up on his closer, especially if it's a veteran, you know, Wickren. He's not going to give up on him too early, so he's got love some leash, and he's got a job and one of the best rotations in baseball. Yeah, that's, he's better than Kimbrell and, yeah, that the rest of that group.
Of course, the elephant in the room in that bullpen is Emmanuel Clase, who obviously has a talent but has not pitched a day in a Cleveland uniform yet. And so I think a lot of people are taking spec picks on him late in drafts just because the talent is obviously there, but obviously no experience in Cleveland as of yet. Both Wickery and Clase have been drafted 12 out of the last 43 online championships at the same ADP, about 354 and a half. And so it's interchangeable.
Yeah. If Terry Francona was worried about, like, talent as his closer, then we wouldn't be having this conversation, because Karinchak would be the closer, and that would be it. So it's probably Wickren or Karinchak at this point. It looks like Wickren has a very good chance. He might be the favorite to win that job.
All right, guys, we'll move on from the Cleveland bullpen to, mentioned it in passing in past conversations, but I'm going to reach out to you guys about handcuffs. And I had a couple drafts myself, and I picked some handcuffs. I'll throw mine at the end. But Kevin, talk to me about any drafts that you've done where you felt you needed to pick up a handcuff, and what handcuffs are you targeting? And this doesn't have to be in a drafting hole. I think that's where it's most common to pick up the handcuff for a closer that you think might lose the job, or just in case something were to happen, you've got the saves from that team, from that bullpen. Give me a handcuff that you are targeting or have considered in previous drafts.
I'm going to start with one that fell apart because it was a true handcuff. In TGFBI, I took Leclerc in the 16th round as my second closer. I believe I took Rosenthal in the 6th. And in the 23rd round, I took Jonathan Hernandez. And I thought that was a perfect example of a handcuff, because Leclerc, it seems, has that job. But it also seems it might not be very secure. And at the time, if he were to lose it, most of us were fairly certain it would be Jonathan Hernandez that took the role. So that a true handcuff in that scenario. 45 minutes after I made the pick, the news broke about Jonathan Hernandez's injury. And I hope the best for him. He's worse off than we are as fantasy players, for sure. But anyway, I'm keeping my eye on in that same situation now. We talk about managers liking these veteran guys that have done it before. And Ian Kennedy is a non-roster invitee on that team. And just yesterday, threw a clean inning as the third pitcher in the game, in that range where we see closers this time of year, with 2 strikeouts. So keeping my eye on him, don't have him on any teams, but he's definitely on my radar. I think this gives Leclerc more security before anything like that would happen. Another guy that we've talked about over the last episode or two is, I think Mike Matheny really likes Josh Staumont. I think he's very similar to Trevor Rosenthal, who he liked, a flamethrower, a lot of strikeouts, high velocity. They're going with Greg Holland. If he falters, I think Matheny's move, as good as Scott Barlow and Jesse Hahn can be, and some people like them better than Staumont, I think Staumont is Matheny's type of player to be in that role. So I like him a lot. And then for my third, it's more of a pairing, and maybe even more than the two, as what Rick brought up earlier, and we were talking about it pre-show and then a few minutes ago, that the Rays closer situation hasn't typically been as crazy as it was last season. And I'm not interested in Nick Anderson at pick 145, but I'll take Diego Castillo at 300 and Pete Fairbanks at 363 and maybe put them both in my lineup and think I might have a chance at half of the Reyes saves, great ratios, strikeouts for both of them, and Volter some wins as well. And as much as what we saw in the regular season from the Rays last season, when it got to the postseason, when it came down to it, Diego Castillo was closing games. So I feel like taking a shot there.
Yeah, another name, this is a shot in the dark, very deep sleeper candidate in Texas would be Hunter Wood's been getting a lot of praise this spring training. I think he's got a ton of strikeouts. I know he didn't even pitch last year, but if there's so many, and Matt Bush is back, there's a lot of names that, like, Ian Kennedy, again, like, I love the Kennedy pick because just 2 years ago, he was legitimate, like, pretty good closer for Kansas City. You know, he's not that far removed from that season there. But yeah, to your point, it just further gives Leclerc more breathing room for that to keep that job. But we've seen him have his ups and downs there. So you should be looking for whoever the next guy is going to be there. So yeah, I'm going to go with the three guys. Whoever loses out in the closer battles in, you know, St. Louis, Philadelphia, and Cincinnati right now, whoever wins the job in those spots is likely going to be have a short leash and from the get-go. So the loser might end up closing out games by the end of April. For what it's worth, I'm heavily in on Giovanni Gallegos and Hector Neris this season, especially after Neris is throwing this slider now that looks really good. Jordan Hicks is great. He's going to be a great closer, but coming back from Tommy John, it would make sense for the Cardinals to be play it safe with him and not throw him into a role where he is going to be pitching high leverage situations, possibly on back-to-back days. And the other one, yeah, Cincinnati. I've really like Amir Garrett, although his ADP is creeping up, and he and Lucas Sims are actually, they're both injured right now, and they're both on the same recovery timeline. So you could get Lucas Sims probably at a pretty good discount. But that said, I love Amir Garrett because he just has that. He has the mentality you want to see out of a closer. He tweeted out today, hashtag closerAG, after he threw a simulated game, I believe. So he's just, that's the type of guy you want to see in the role.
Yeah, he's been lobbying for a long time for this.
I love seeing the back and forth with him and Lucas Sims earlier this offseason on Twitter. And obviously it looks like that they have a great relationship if they're able to do that publicly on social media. But it's a fun little competition they have going on. It was interesting to see them both getting injured really back to back almost. And the jokes about when they signed Sean Doolittle, how, oh, they got another closer option. Ha ha ha. Oh, wait. Yeah, no, they might have to. They might have to.
And the second series of the year is against the Pirates, and we know he really likes those guys.
Oh, yeah. It's to the Doolittle point, I almost, his velocity's back up this spring, which I don't count out Sean Doolittle. It's, again, another guy who's 2 years removed from being like a dominant closer in this league. And if his velocity's back, then that's a three-headed, it's going to be a headache to figuring out who's going to get saves there. But yeah, Doolittle's definitely worth mentioning.
Yeah, the one handcuff that I've had the opportunity to take on is Kirby Yates and Jordan Romano in a couple of drafts and holds. Literally, while you guys were talking, I drafted Jordan Romano in my final draft and hold. And I already had Kirby Yates earlier on in the draft as well. I've got two of that handcuffs. I think that it's pretty obvious the reason why there. It's like, to your point, Rick, earlier, like, you love having a guy like Yates just because that, you know what that upside is, what he can be. He's shown it. But you do worry, obviously, about coming back from the injury, how much they're going to push him, / you know, when he might break. And if I'm not mistaken, he's only on a 1 year deal with the Blue Jays as well. I have a feeling he's going to push himself as much as the Blue Jays are going to also push him, knowing that what's there to lose. And he wants to prove that he can sign a 3 or 4 year contract after this is all done. So he's going to want to show what he's made of and not a tiptoe around it. The more you push, the more chance you have of irritating something. And then Romano is, I drafted Romano as the closer earlier in the offseason before that happened, thinking Toronto was not going to spend money in that direction. Like, I knew they were going to, everybody knew they were going to spend money. I just didn't think it was going to be in the bullpen, or at least I didn't think it was going to be on a guy like Yates or a guy, an established closer, especially what after Romano showed what he could do last year. And actually in the last 2 years, he's been stellar, and we'll talk about him a little bit later, I think. So I think that's an easy handcuff, especially in a draft and hold situation where one guy goes down, you've got the backup. So you're at least getting the saves from that bullpen. And I don't see a lot of other guys now that Anthony Bass has moved on to Miami. They don't have a, there's not another guy that you can see stepping into that role immediately, or at least giving Romano a lot of push. Rick, please correct me if I'm wrong. I'm going to have to get ahead of this before we start doing the daily reports, but I don't see anybody by looking at their current bullpen roster that I think that I'm scared of.
Yeah, the only other name would be Rafael Dolis. But yeah, it's like those two and Yates, that's your 7th, 8th, 9th setup combination. And we're going to get to Romano in a little bit, but he really excites me. And I think that's a great pick, regardless of whether or not he's closing out games for them. He can still help you out.
Yeah, so the thing, we keep talking about it, so we're going to get to Romano right now. Spoiler. So the next question I have for Rick is, Rick, I want you to give our listeners 3 relievers that they should be at least looking at, if not fully targeting in their drafts, to roster, even in a non-holds league, and guys that are not getting saves, at least not to start the season. And these are guys that I think that you could recommend holding on to all year round. And I don't think it's a guy you're going to talk about. One guy that I recommended last week was Alex Reyes. And now that he's going to be in a reliever role all year round, at least what they announced, they have a target of 100 innings for him this year. And as a reliever with the talent level that Reyes has, he can be more valuable than most starters actually coming off a shortened season, and where you just don't know what the limitations are going to be on most starters. You have a team like Milwaukee who said that they're only going to add 100 innings onto all their starters, and guys who only went 50, 60 innings last year, you can't expect them to go 200. So you might expect Woodruff to go 200 in a normal year, but you can't expect that this year based on what they've said. So give me some other relievers, not Alex Reyes. And after reading through your notes, you weren't going to mention him anyway, so I'm not taking anything from you. So that's good. Romano is one of the guys you're going to talk about, but who else we got?
Yeah. So for non-closer relievers to be rostered, you need them to contribute in at least 3 categories, which is ERA, WHIP, and Ks. So Devin Williams is someone who's getting drafted everywhere, so I won't mention him. But yeah, Jordan Romano is the first name that came to mind. His fastball was fantastic last year, and he's actually added velocity this spring. He had a 52.4% whiff rate on his fastball, and now I think he's up around 97, 98, 99 this spring. So he's back from that injury that he finished the year with last year. He seems healthy. He's ready to go. Someone who's not exactly healthy and ready to go yet, but could be huge for fantasy managers, is Tanner Rainey, who profiles similar to James Karinchak. Elite swing and miss stuff. His slider had a 73% whiff rate last year, which I don't even, that's just not realistic. That's video game numbers. So yeah, he's another guy who brings like an upper 90s fastball with that slider. So he's one of those elite closer to be types. And then pretty much any reliever in the White Sox bullpen can probably help you out for fantasy purposes, because that bullpen is just silly at this point. Kopech, Crochet, Cody Hewer. No one's probably going to even see him or mention him, but he had a 67% whiff rate on his slider. Evan Marshall had an unreal year. He had one of the best curves, maybe the best curveball in baseball last year. Aaron Bummer, that bullpen just...
We forgot all about that guy. From 3 months ago, he was the talk of the town.
He was the closer, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and with Reyes, I think you can... Maybe the White Sox have something similarly planned with Kopech, where he's going to be a reliever, but I think they're going to try to get him maybe some starts, or he's going to get more innings than the average reliever. And maybe he follows some starters who only work 4 or 5 innings, and he can vulture some wins for you too. But he and Crochet, both guys bring in 100+ miles per hour. They're going to get a bunch of strikeouts. Yeah, that bullpen is just loaded with talent.
Kevin, how often do you find yourself filling a roster, whether it be your 9th pitcher or Devin Williams type, with a non-closer reliever? And has it worked? Have you felt like if you've done it, have you felt like it's worked out for you? Or is it a strategy that it's not really, your cup of tea?
No, I think it has worked for me in the past. But I think in 2020, in the short season, I think there was a popular belief that these were the guys that were going to run our fantasy baseball rosters. Nobody was going to get innings. Nobody was going to start games and get wins. And these were the guys that were going to win leagues for us. So the ones that everybody wanted were being overdrafted. And then we had guys like Rainey that Rick just mentioned that wasn't really drafted for that role, but ended up working out that way for a lot of people. And I think it's going to work again, like it did work in 2019 and a couple of years prior, as the trend of pitchers, starting pitchers, not throwing as many innings has been going on for a while. And we expected it to be much more exaggerated in 2020 than it actually ended up being. The trend continued, but I think everybody expected starters were going to go three or four innings, and that's not what happened. So the answer is yes, I do these guys. And I think some of them that will help us are actually becoming lower priced, for lack of a better phrase, for us again since 2020. And all the guys Rick mentioned, like the Rays guys I mentioned earlier, a lot of these guys, they'll vulture some wins. Once in a while, they'll chip in a save, but they're going to get us strikeouts and they're going to get us ERA and whip.
Yeah, it also, it's going to matter on your format as well. It's a format we don't talk about nearly enough, especially since all of our, you know, pitcher list staff leagues are head to head. We don't talk about these enough, but like in a head to head league, like the strategy of punting starting pitching and just filling a roster with these type of guys is totally viable, and being able to get a guys that are going to make you somewhat competitive in strikeouts if you have another starter or two, like a Rainey or Romano, who have high K rates and they're going to help your ratios, and you're going to be able to win three out of the five categories every week, and combine that with some elite closers and you get four with the saves. These are the type of guys that are super cheap and they can take your team in a completely different direction than what your average fantasy manager is doing. So
yeah, daily change leagues as well. You can fill up, you can have a, they're not all going to throw that day, but you can have a possibility of everybody in your lineup throwing that day.
Yeah, because they're not as predictable as a starter. When your starters are good, they announce it. But you know that if Rainey went 2 days in a row, he's probably not going to pitch the next day. So you can feel pretty good dropping him and picking him back up after he clears waivers in your league. Or yep, you notice that he hasn't pitched in 3 or 4 days. They're going to throw him in whether they're winning or losing, because they need to, you know, make sure he keeps getting the work. So they're a little bit more predictable than I think people give him credit for. All right. And the last topic we're going to talk about is what happens every year. Closers get built up by average to below average teams just to, so they can become trade bait. So you got guys that are moving teams at the deadline or right before or before the deadline. And so, Rick, can you give me some trade candidates and then who their inevitable replacement will be that people should be targeting, whether they target them in drafts or they target them in July?
So at this point, the two big fish in this equation would be Josh Hader, who it just feels like he's been mentioned in trade talks with other teams for 2 or 3 years now. It just hasn't stopped. So it feels just inevitable that he's going to get dealt. And then the other one would be Raisel Iglesias, who I could see him being moved twice this year and being a contract year for him. So with Hader, the obvious replacement would probably be Devin Williams, but there's some other guys in that boat, like we talked about, if maybe they just want to keep Williams in that 7th, 8th inning role, the original Josh Hader role. And there's some other, Justin Topa throws hard. He could be a sneaky good saves candidate late in the year. If Freddy Peralta ends up staying in the bullpen, he's a great bullpen arm for them. And for the Angels, so they would only probably trade Iglesias if they're out of the playoff race yet again. And sorry for Mike Trout, but hopefully they can compete this year and they don't have to trade him. But if they do, Mike Myers, he really blew up last year and he was one of the best relievers in baseball over the last month or two. So I think he would get the first shot, but Felix Pena is still there. He was also, he's one of those guys who's gone back and forth between the rotation and the bullpen, but he's definitely a better fit for the bullpen for them. You could also see, same thing can be said about the Nationals or the Blue Jays. If they fall out of the playoff race, Brad Hand, Kirby Yates, 1 year deals, veterans, they could be flipped. And the guys we've already talked about, Rainey and Romano, could finally start getting saves for their respective teams. And more lower on the closer totem pole, I'd say the Red Sox could wind up sellers again with, you know, Matt Barnes as a free agent to be, Adam Ottavio could be dealt. And Sawamura, he hasn't looked good in spring, but all the reports I read about him coming over from Japan, he sounds like he could really be a closer in this league given his splitter fastball combination.
I think everybody in my, maybe not everybody, but a couple teams in my home dynasty league really want Darwin Hernandez to end up being a closer there, is because he's been drafted and dropped and drafted and dropped a couple times since making his early debut, myself included, to be fair.
Yeah, I've held on to him in a dynasty league. I'm just waiting.
He has the stuff, no doubt. Yeah, got to work on that command.
Yeah, because guys who close, closers who walk every other batter don't typically hold on to the role that much for that long. Jose Leclerc being the exception, perhaps. Oh, so those are all, that's all really good. Kevin, when it comes to these guys who are going to get traded, you know, at what point in the season do you look to buy the relievers off the wire in anticipation of a trade rather than saying waiting until after the trade happens and having, again, even though it's past midseason, whoever's got the hammer is going to win those situations. Do you look to anticipate those, or are you just, would you rather pick up the sure thing?
No, absolutely. We're going to try to anticipate that. And I think we talked about to open the show tonight, 2 weeks ahead may not be enough anymore. Maybe we need to start looking 3 weeks ahead at this kind of thing. And I think when it comes to these guys at the trade deadline, we're looking at the All-Star break being typically the second weekend in July or the first weekend after 4th of July weekend. So we're going to have 2 to 3 weeks until the trade deadline. And I think a lot of fantasy players, is the way I used to do it, start really diving into my categories and seeing what's what during that All-Star break. And so we need to get out ahead of that. So I'm thinking late June, early July, right? As Rick was talking, the teams that are struggling that have veteran closers, have guys on their last year of their deal, the guys we anticipate are going to be moved, we start looking at who's going to take their spot. And I think, hopefully, if our team is healthy, we got a spot or two. We got room for a couple guys. Like we said, we're making moves every week. If we got a spot or two, we're going to take a shot on a couple of the of those Knicks guys in lines for the guys we think we're moving.
Yeah, I'm going to echo that. And you really have to be active on your wire earlier rather than later. And Kevin, to your point, like an episode or two ago, it's like you don't have time to wait. Like you don't, you just don't. You don't have time to wait and see. You can't take the wait and see approach.
It's okay to be wrong. And it's okay to be wrong a lot, because when you're right a time or two, it's going to make up for it and more.
Yeah. And when you're wrong that early, you're not spending the money. Like again, if you're spending $1 to $15 a fab, if you feel bad, but it's mostly just in your head. You're not going to miss the $10 or the $5 that you threw out at a speculative closer if you have the ability and the flexibility, to your point. If you don't have the injuries, things aren't building up where you need that roster spot for something else, to hold on to a guy for 3 weeks and it fail, and then you drop them. It's really similar to what we're talking about, like these late round picks that we talk about. What do you have to lose? It's like you pick Bobby Witt Jr. and he doesn't get called up, and maybe he's your first cut, or maybe you hold on to him for 2 or 3 weeks until you need the roster spot, and you don't feel bad about it because you weren't using that roster spot anyway. Again, unless you were really risky in your draft and you picked a couple stashes that you're going to want to hold on to. If you're one of the guys that wants to draft Severino or the guys that had Tommy John, and that roster spot is just gone for the first couple months of the year, you handcuff yourself a little bit more. But it's way better in the fab game to spend the speculative money rather than having to fight it out against the other 11, the other 14 teams that are all looking at the same guy when they become the closer, when they're thrust into the role. And then there's no guarantee you're going to get them, because everybody's spending. Right. Everybody knows they're going to have to spend $100, $200, $300 of their fab on a $1,000 budget. And now you're getting to a point where you're like, now if I really want them, I've got to spend $400. To be guaranteed that I'm going to get them, where you could have wasted, quote unquote, wasted $5 or $10 2 or 3 weeks in advance.
And you can do it every week. It's in that budget. When I talk, I think if I'm starting in my head with 800 instead of 1,000, because I'm saving some for that one that I really want to go after, but that averages to 30 a week. I don't need 30 a week. And at the end of the year, I really, for the last month to 6 weeks, I really only need 20. Hopefully. Other people are going to be out of money. other people aren't even going to be bidden anymore. And so I'm starting my season with an average of about 40 a week for the first month to 6 weeks. If I'm spending $5 every single week on one of these closers, I only got to find one. I really only got to find one if one or two that I drafted are working out the way that I planned. One more, adding one to that is going to be huge.
That's absolutely true. All right. Well, I think that is going to do it for this week's On the Wire, our final off-season episode. I want to give some extra love to Rick. Rick, why don't you let everybody, first of all, thank you so much for being our final guest of the off-season and for taking the time.
Thank you for having me. I had a lot of fun. Yeah, this is great.
So why don't you let everybody know where they can find your work, what kind of work you do, and then where they can find you on social media and what have you.
Yeah, so I'm the reliever manager over at pitcherlist.com. I'm sure if anyone's seen any closer rankings or reliever rankings, that's my work. We also have the bullpen charts we're bringing back again this year, which Adam helps out with, does a great job with. It's really it's a great tool that when we're talking about picking up relievers who may not get saves, but they're going to help you with other things on a day-to-day basis. That's a great tool to use on a day-to-day basis. So yeah, you can find me also at Twitter at I am Rick Graham, and yeah.
Great. And we'll have links to all that in the show notes. You guys in the podcast notes, you can check that out. As always, make sure to follow us on the Twitter at On the Wire Pod and join PL Plus on pitcherlist.com. You can pick our brains, Rick's brain, and a countless others' brains on the Pitcherlist Discord on a daily basis. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen, and leaving us a rating review is always appreciated and very helpful for a young pod like ourselves. Special thanks again to Rick Graham for joining us and helping us make some sense and making us feel just a little bit less dirty about drafting closers early and other bullpen situations across the league. You can check out all of Rick's work, including his bullpen reports, over at pitcherlist.com, and you follow him on Twitter. Check that link out in the show notes. And for Kevin Hastings, I am Adam Howe, and with that, we bid you goodbye.